You know, I made kind of an early mistake, and I should know it as old as I am, but I kind of got all into gear there.
Welcome to episode 62 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented to you by XO Mountain Gear. In this episode, we have a repeat guest. Way back in episode 5, we spoke with Rob Shaw, and he's back to join us for this episode as well. Rob is a strength and conditioning coach at a gym in Jackson, Wyoming. But it's not the gym you're thinking of. It's not bodybuilding, it's not meatheads, it's not a gym where you perform in the gym. It's not a gym that's about just looking good. It's a gym that's all about performance and the outdoors, and specifically in the mountains and the backcountry. Rob works with professional athletes, with military, with tactical athletes, guys who climb mountains for a living, guys who endure the outdoors for a living, and he helps them be better prepared. Rob himself is a passionate hunter, which we talk about in the first bit of this episode, really just catching up on Rob's season. This was his first year bow hunting after spending many years meat hunting with a firearm. And so Rob had a lot of lessons that he learned this fall, and we get the opportunity to learn alongside with him as he shares those lessons in this episode. Of course, being a strength and conditioning coach at a gym and training mountain athletes, we dive into a bit of that as well. So we do talk fitness and training in the second half of this episode. If you guys haven't caught it yet, you don't have to listen to Rob's first episode with us. Episode 5 is a prerequisite to this one, but I would actually highly encourage you to go back and do that. Rob has some programs written specifically to prepare for backcountry big game hunting, and we actually dove deeper into those in that first episode with Rob, episode 5 of the podcast, more so than we did even in this episode. So these two episodes combined are a great 1-2 punch of training knowledge if you are ready to step up your game and hunt the backcountry more effectively. One last thing before we dive into the show, just want to thank you guys for the comments and the ideas that you have sent in thus far for what you want to see from the podcast in 2017, and just want to give one last call for you guys to do that. Just email us to podcast@exomountaingear.com with any ideas that you want us to tackle, any questions you want answered, topics or guests that you want to see on the show, and we will do our best to make that happen in this upcoming year. As always, thank you guys so much for listening. You can find the show notes for this episode at exomountaingear.com/62. For 62. And in those show notes, I share my experience with Rob's programs, some of my favorite exercises and movements that I picked up from Rob's programs, and more. So be sure to check that out. Okay, here's the show with Rob Shaw of Mountain Tactical. All right, well, Rob, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good, Mark.
Good.
How are you?
Yeah, well, thank you. Steve, you're online. How you doing, buddy?
Good. Yeah, it's a beautiful snowy day here in Boise for sure. So
nice. Yeah, we're just post-Christmas. This one should be coming out just after the new year. So timely episode for guys who are getting ready for next season. But before we talk about next season and getting ready for next season, I'd love to talk to you, Rob, about this past season. You know, you're a previous guest, you were way, way back on episode 5, which seems like an eternity ago, and we talked about fitness for hunting and some of your experience there and what you have to offer, which we'll certainly get to. But I know that in 2016, you spent a fair amount of time bow hunting as well, kind of did some new adventures, learned some new lessons, things like that. So where can you get us started on the hunting side of things? Just tell us about your season and how that's been for you in 2016.
Yeah, you know, I kind of a meat rifle hunter before. Last year, I kind of dabbled a little bit around in bow hunting, but last year, I decided to kind of take a turn and really hit it hard. And in hindsight, it was like my best season ever hunting, and also my worst season ever.
That's a familiar feeling.
You know, on my And I guess I can start with the worst. I wasn't able to harvest an animal with a bow. So that, I guess, is maybe a worst part. But maybe the best part for me was that not harvesting an animal, but spending so much time out there and seeing so many incredible sights and having so many incredible experiences. It took me, you know, a while to get into it, and some frustration and some missed opportunities before I realized for me what hunting is about. And as kind of a, you know, rifle meat hunter before, I'd taste a little bit about that, but I was really, you know, I'd wait to the end of the season and just go shoot a cow or something like that. But for me, this year really turned out to be about spending time in the mountains, about appreciating what hunting does in terms of making you pay attention to your time in the mountains, about exploring new areas. Even though I'm fifth generation, you know, Wyomingite, and I've lived in this area, you know, for 48 years, minus my service time, man, I saw just some incredible new areas and explored some new places. So in hindsight, the little bit of bitter is getting less and less, and the great experiences I had is more and more, and it's really changed the way I think about hunting, and I think in a mature way and in a better way. I know here I'm not much of a climber, but I work with a lot of climbers, and every once in a while they'll take me out rock climbing. And I remember this real good climber telling me one time, he says, "You know who the best climber is?" And he had a big smile on his face, and I said, "Who?" And he says, "It's the guy who's having the most fun." And I think it took me this season kind of realize that's kind of what it is for hunting too.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that. Was this something like this whole change in perspective? Did you sort of feel that during the hunt, or during the hunt were you just like so focused and not, you didn't have that sort of detachment and perspective, and it's not till after season that you're sort of looking back and seeing this perspective? How did that work for you?
You know, I was able to, I guess, grow up pretty early during the hunt and kind of start to realize what it was really about. My season was kind of interesting. I started, you know, scouting for deer, you know, probably the middle of June, and I was, you know, hitting it hard every weekend, you know, a couple nights every weekend, and going to these new places, and you know, it took me two or three trips just to spot a bedded deer. But man, I was so excited when I spotted that first bedded deer. It was amazing. And then here in Wyoming, I drew an antelope tag. Even residents have to draw an antelope tag here. And the area I drew in, it's not like, you know, the grasslands or the brush. It's like kind of hilly, and antelope get up in the hills. And then, so on August 15th, I started antelope hunting. And I ended up making, I think I finished at 27 failed stalks.
Wow.
On some type, I was busted every which way. At first, those freaking animals are amazing.
Yeah, their sight and everything.
Oh my God. I mean, it made me such a better hunter. But I was busted by sage chicken, by other antelope. I went up after the rifle season started. I was busted by a four wheeler. I got close a couple times. I missed one time. I got really close a couple times. I know that one of the things you read about first time bow hunters, if you get a first shot, you should take it. I made this really kind of fun, incredible stalk where I was like climbing underneath trees and over logs and got into this, I was got about 40, 50 yards away from this bedded group, antelope. There's one big buck there and a shitload of does. And I had a shot at the doe, but of course I wanted the buck. And so I ended up getting busted and missing that opportunity. But yeah, I think, just paying attention, you know, to the animals and just to the mountains. It really made me see mountains in a different light. As I've gotten older, you know, I'm 48 now. When I was, you guys are in your 30s, right? Still?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I was in my 30s. I just like going fast in the mountains. I was never much of a rock climber per se, but, you know, I'm talking, you know, we did the Gannett Peak from Elkhart and Trailhead there, and near Pinedale. It's like a 50-mile trip in 24 hours, you know, just in and out early, like going out and doing 20-mile trips really fast. And some of the stuff, like I saw you guys did your 40-mile suffer fast. We do that all the time. In fact, people didn't like going with me because that's what I like to do.
Just go, 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 go.
But as I got older, I kind of found I don't like moving as fast in the mountains anymore. Mm. I changed from a workout to something different. And so this year's hunting really, really helped, I guess, coincide with that. And so after I was able to slow down and stop being a punk and kind of realize how blessed I was to be doing what I was, where I was doing it, it really ended up being a great season. But I certainly learned some lessons.
Yeah. Man, that's so cool to hear that perspective, for sure.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, so many of us are just hard chargers, so focused on, like, getting the job done that, you know, we miss out on what's happening around us in the moment. That's a good lesson to learn, for sure. So what are some of the specifics that stand out to you, Rob, going from, you know, a rifle hunter or just, you know, maybe just hunting later in the season versus earlier in the season, just the differences in the timing of archery, things like that, like getting down to specific lessons or things that stand out or different approaches that you'll take next year?
You know, I made kind of an early mistake, and I should know it as old as I am, but I kind of got all into gear there. You know, I think starting about this time last year, you know, I think I went down and bought one of them new Matthews bows in February or something and started shooting it. And I think mm-hmm. I bought the bow because it was like the, you know, that all the reviews had it as the best bow. And then I started shooting it and I kind of changed my release round. And anyway, my big lesson coming, look in hindsight, was there are so many different distractions out there that kind of keep you from what's important, I think, about hunting. And gear is one, you know, all these just different gear discussions and all that stuff.
Yeah.
There's guys on the industry side, I think, and it's kind of their goal to, you know, keep you talking about it all year long and end up selling you stuff. And I think you get caught up, and I call it a circle jerk. Guys back and forth, you know, and you'll hear the guys like, oh, we got lots of synergies between you and me, and that's always a so those were the other thing, just in terms of my own shooting, you know, I never really shot a bow much, but, you know, I was really working on, God, I chased that damn arrow around the target a bazillion times and was really looking on getting really accurate, really fast. And, you know, when I missed a couple bucks this year, and I think I missed one at like 60 and one at 40, and especially the one at 40. I mean, I should have hit that buck, but, you know, it's one thing to obviously shoot, you know, in your backyard, there's no stress, and shoot under stress. And I've developed a way to train marksmanship under stress with assault rifles. We use it with our military guys. And, you know, so after I had that experience, I started applying that same theory to my bow hunting, understanding you don't need to hit a 2-inch target. You have to hit, you know, a 12-inch target or 9-inch or whatever it is under stress. And so that was one distraction, was just spending so much time almost not necessarily overthinking shooting, but not doing it in something that would transfer to the field. Mm-hmm. I'm not a target shooter, right?
Right.
That was a big, big distraction. It was interesting, too. I didn't get distracted on the fitness side, but it's kind of interesting in kind of the hunting thing, the industry thing with some of the events that going on. I was at my local shop. I think it was July 14th or something, right around the middle of July. You know, I was looking at gear. I should have been doing something else. I was still obsessed with gear, I guess. And the guys there, hey, you're going to go up to Montana with us to do this, you know, this hunting event. And I was thinking to myself, it's friggin' the middle of July. I mean, no, I'm going to go scout for deer.
Right.
I'm not going to do some artificial hunting event.
Yeah.
I can go actually do the real thing. it's just some of the distractions, I think, that especially on the – I saw that one because I guess I'm – a professional strength conditioning coach, but some of the gear stuff I didn't see, and I'm wise to it now. I was never able to get comfortable with that bow I got, so I ended up getting another one. I think it's on your recommendation, Steve or Mark. You guys used to shoot primes or something. The local shop started selling primes. At one shot, one of them primes, like, gosh, this thing's simple and easy.
Yeah, they're really nice bows for sure.
So I got one of those, and I'm not going to be getting a new bow this year. But anyway, that's some of the lessons learned. I learned for sure.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Could you dive into, and this kind of brings it back to, something that I love about what you guys do, and it's more than just fitness and strength and conditioning. And I guess just to give listeners who are new, we should back up and kind of, Rob, let you introduce more of what Mountain Tactical Institute is about. Really, it was called Mountain Athlete back when we had you on the show, and there's been some changes there, so we could certainly cover that. But go ahead and give us some context, but B, I want to get back into that research piece that you mentioned about shooting under stress with your tactical athletes. And then I would love to hear more about how you applied that to your bow shooting. But first, I guess let's go ahead and back up and give that bigger picture about what is the Mountain Tactical Institute from a fitness and research and, all the areas that you guys are working in right now.
Yeah, we started back almost 10 years ago with Mountain Athlete. I changed careers and came up here to Jackson. I was working in town a little bit south of here. Opened a gym, wanted to work with the guides and stuff, and CrossFit was just coming on right now. So I think we were the first kind of garage gym here in Jackson, and made all kinds of mistakes. What we kind of found both on the mountain and tactical side was all that matters is outside performance. And nothing in the gym matters. All that matters is how well you perform doing the event. And it took me a while to kind of figure that out. And then once I did, I was surprised to learn that in the strength and conditioning world, there really hadn't been much theory developed to determine what matters. And then also, how do you train for that? Over the years, we almost always kind of been a research facility in the sense that we've identified kind of what matters, developed programming to train for that, assessed how the programming worked, fixed it, or tried to fix it, changed it, tried it again, and just this loop, continual loop of, theory, develop, assess, redeploy, try it again. And a couple years ago, we really started taking a hard look on the research side and getting into the more scientific research on the strength conditioning side. We kind of found that the academic approach to research in general wasn't a good fit for what we wanted to do. We want all of our stuff that we reproduce to really have a mission direct application. And so what we found with typical academic research on the strength and conditioning side was that it's designed primarily to get published and to meet the criteria to get published and get through the boards. It has to be super, super narrow. And it gets so narrow, in fact, it almost loses its applicability to the real world. I say lots of times how many studies have been completed on the proper depth or squat depth for back squats. Mm-hmm. probably 10,000 of them, and they all got published. But Jesus, how many times can you hammer that? we developed our own research approach we call mission direct research, and there's some significant differences. We're not interested in the best answer. We're interested in something that we can apply now and that can make a difference now. And then we'll keep on trying to find that right, the best answer. But if we can give our athletes some information, a way to train or something else that will make their mission performance better now, we want to do that. What we started doing was expanding beyond fitness and to take a look at other areas of mission performance, gear, clothing, policy for law enforcement, and on the mountain side, kind of looking at avalanche education. We've done some interesting work there. And so now we're kind of looking and working in all these different areas. For me, it's really exciting. Our company, you know, our kind of our mission is to improve mission performance for mountain and tactical athletes and keep them safe. And by working in all these different areas, we're asking, I think, some questions that nobody else is asking. We're doing some research and looking at some areas that no one else is really interested in. It seems like the research that's been done is either super high level, where it's in, you know, strategy or policy, or so narrow it's not applicable. So we're interested in, you know, and stuff that people can use. Just a couple examples on the gear side. You know, we were interested in testing sleeping bag performance in a real world way. The way sleeping bags are rated, they send off to these different labs. There's testing facilities. There's some in Europe, some here, and they have this really kind of I think they put a dummy in the sleeping bag, you know, and it's really specific. But it turns out that some of the labs, you know, have a little bit of different ways they tweak stuff. Mm-hmm. We were just interested to see if the North Face 20-degree bag kept something as warm as a Marmot 20-degree bag, you know. And so we designed one of the things about our Mission Direct research is we want to develop research that is applicable, but also that can be repeated. So we're constantly looking to develop testing procedures that someone else could do, anyone else could do, really, wherever they're at. On the sleeping bag thing, we ended up putting bottles. I have one of the guys who trains with me. He's an assistant manager at one of the local grocery stores. And so we ended up putting bottles of water, testing the temperature before and after, and sleeping bags in his freezer, his walk-in freezer for ice cream. And believe it or not, we got some great data out of that. And we're just, you know, kind of applying stuff like that. We, you guys both use jet boils or something similar, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We were kind of interested to see how many liters of water you could boil with one of those small canisters that, you know, cause I'm always like, oh, should I bring a new canister? You know, how many, you know, I think we got like 11 liters or 22. I forget what it was. It was amazing. I had an intern here last summer, just boiling canisters of water just to see, you know. So that's some news you can use. We took a hard look at stuff would apply to you guys. We took a hard look at what were the biggest calories for the buck in terms of freeze-dried food, candy bars, stuff like that. Turns out that the biggest calories for the buck and per ounce freeze-dried, I think, is Mountain House mac and cheese. I think the biggest calories per buck just in raw calories is like a Twix bar or peanut butter Twix bar in terms of its weight also. So we're trying to look at not only kind of hardcore research, but just some interesting stuff like that that the athletes we work with can apply right away to what they do in the field.
Yeah, that's cool. And, you know, on top of that research and, you know, some of the things you mentioned quite a bit, from testing food to, you know, walk-in freezers, but just to reiterate, I mean, even the work that you guys are doing in the gym, you're working with professional athletes all of the time. I mean, you kind of mentioned that you were testing your theories, you're changing your response, you're changing your programming based on outcomes. And a lot of that's done with professional athletes, with tactical athletes, whether that's, you know, law enforcement or military units that you work with. But giving that context back to the shooting stuff, which I'd love to hear more about, you have no doubt worked with a bunch of military and law enforcement athletes, and then even done studies on shooting with them. So what are some of the findings of those studies? And then more specifically, you mentioned you applied that to your bow shooting. What types of things did you apply that helped you with that archery shooting?
On the tactical side, we, years ago, when we first started working with military guys, we had a lieutenant colonel. He was an Air Force special ops guy. And he said, hey, you know, it would be really awesome if you could develop a system to train accurate marksmanship under stress and in a systematic way. And so I bought a couple ARs and spent a buttload on 5.56 ammo. And we started testing this idea out. How could we systematically train accurate marksmanship under stress? In the tactical world with shooting, I mean, there's a bazillion shooting schools and they're all, you know, run by ex-special forces guys. And there's a bunch of different theories about, you know, how you should hold your weapon, how you should mount. I mean, it gets really, plus the weapons themselves, talk about a gear world. I mean, the black rifle gear stuff is, I mean, entire magazines about it, right? Yeah. But we were just interested in, we're not marksmanship instructors. I was in the Coast Guard, for Christ's sake. You know, I never shot an AR. but we were interested in this developing this system. And in the strength and conditioning world, we have something that's called progression. And so, you know, if I have you doing, you know, 10 push-ups this week, and next week I have you do 12 push-ups, and next week I have you do 15 push-ups, that's just called progression. It's a way to keep focused but improve your performance in a systematic way. And so we developed a system we called Range Fitness that systematically trains accurate marksmanship under stress. And there's different stressors that we apply. We apply a little bit of physical stress. There's a time limit. There's an ammo limit. And then under that time limit, ammo limit, they have to hit the target so many times. And if they get that level, then they go up to the next level, which means with the same number, same amount of ammo, same amount of time, they have to hit the target more times. And so it took us a long time to do this. When we first started, we got really elaborate. You know, we had guys doing sandbag get-ups and running around the block, you know, and this and that. And as we developed it more and more, the what we've kind of learned in all the work that I do is that, and I'm sure you've seen it just with the packs you guys are working on, is that sophisticated design is immature. Really good design is really simple, right? You're laughing. You know what that's like.
couldn't be more better stated, yeah.
But the interesting thing about that maturity, when I say mature, it's not like you're an immature pack designer. The design itself is immature, and it takes, you know, churning and use and thought, and the design itself matures. And that happened with our Range Fitness, and we got away from doing all these exotic exercises to doing either burpees or short sprints. And we developed really effective methods of, you know, just really testing this. We found out with hitting the target that we developed these drills, but we found out that we could only advance so far just doing the drills. We had to step back and do some fundamentals, fundamental shooting, trigger control, you know, or jerk, you know, same thing in bow stuff, sight picture, you know, all those types of things. And then we started working those fundamentals into these, what we call them training sessions. And the training sessions would begin with a stress drill, and then it would end with a stress drill. And so over the course of time, we developed this system, and we deployed the system with lots of different experienced shooters. And it was really interesting to see the response, because even, you know, special forces guys get caught up in gear and image and everything else. And so we'd go out and we'd shoot with the special forces team. And when everybody first does this, just about everybody sucks at it. They're just not used to it. It's like a new drill, right? What we found, though, is that the experienced guys, the real professionals, the quiet professionals who weren't caught up in ego, they would kind of step back, start paying attention more to their fundamentals, and quickly get better at it. The young guys who were new and had all those other things going on, well, they just get more and more pissed off. They get mad at me. They blame the drill. They say the target was too far away, was too small, yada, yada, yada. But you know, that the experience of good shooters, they would steadily improve. And what we heard from everybody was that no matter what a level shooter they are, is that doing the drills made them become a better shooter because they had to really concentrate on fundamentals. So the drills themselves improved fundamentals. One of the things that is key to this, and I actually had an engineer working on this on the archery side this summer, was we use metal targets for the AR shooting, and they're reactive. So if you hit it, you know, which is good because it knows if you made a hit. It adds stress if you miss it. And we'll do these with guys next to each other. And so if the other guy is going ping, 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 and you're not, it adds stress, right? It's good. We're interested in increasing the stress on you. I hired it. I had a mechanical engineer on staff this summer working on a couple projects for us, and one of them was a reactive target for archery. We weren't able to develop this, but I knew that for range fitness, for archery perspective, we need to develop a reactive target. You need to know if you hit the target right when you make the shot. You can't pick up your binoculars or walk down there. You need to know right then. And we tried all types of different things. We tried a light system, and we wanted to develop something ideally that guys could just put on their regular foam target. Spent a lot of money and did a lot of geeky stuff, but weren't quite able to get it right. And so I'm still kind of working on that. What I've come to use is just balloons with a little bit of baby powder in them. A balloon is about the right size. And if you have two or three targets, you can get two or three balloons up. Mm-hmm. But essentially, what you do is I'm still kind of working through this, and I'll be doing a lot of it here this winter in my gym. Can shoot in my gym, it's just long enough. Last year we would do like we like 15 meters for a sprint, so we do 4 15 meter shuttle sprints. So at the firing line, down back under a certain time limit, and we would keep the arrow notched in the bow, you know, your release on the bow ready to go, so you're actually running kind of ready to shoot, right? Like an elf and a hobbit, I don't know. But you'd run back and forth as fast as you could in a certain time limit, and then you'd come to full draw, and you'd have to hit the target. Ideally, if you can set up 3 or 4 balloons on your target, you can do, you know, 4 of those iterations before you have to go down and get your arrows and start again. So I'm still researching exactly the best way to do it, but you need to know when you hit the target. And what it does, I think it does a couple things. It helps you train that stress, so you're used to doing it. It's not perfect, even on the range fitness side. It's not perfect. We can't, in a systematic way, replicate the stress of fear, right? Mm-hmm. And we can't necessarily replicate the stress, you know, that I certainly felt, my heart's thumping, that buck in front of me that I missed. But I can get used to having a time limit and shooting with my heart thumping, and also getting better and more accurate under those situations. And so we'll be working on that pretty hard this winter, and I hope to publish, you know, some of our findings here after we come up with the drills and how we train it, and also working on the fundamentals that transfer to accurate marksmanship under stress, right? Maybe it isn't all the fundamentals you hear about by all the geeky guys on the internet when it comes to bow shooting. It might be some other stuff that works better. All we're interested in doing is increasing your marksmanship under stress. So what we hope to do is be able to develop these drills and that progression and that theory, get it out to guys like you, have you do it, and then see if it helps hunting. if it doesn't help, then we'll you know, fix it, try something else. But that's where we're hoping to go with it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think just that whole mindset of how effective can you be under stress? And by effective, it's not perfect. It's not how small of a group can you shoot. It's can you hit the target or not? And the target can be, you know, that balloon you mentioned, but something the size of vitals or what have you. But man, so many of us, and I'm guilty, especially in the past, of setting up ideal conditions with an ideal stance with no stress, and just seeing how, you know, how small of a group, how, you know, can I launch five arrows in there all within this tiny little spot or whatever? And okay, that can be good, but hitting, you know, a 5-inch or a 6-inch balloon under stress is much more important than throwing five arrows in the size of a half dollar or what have you.
You know what? We've tried to do range fitness with CQB distance. And so that's close quarters battle. That's those guys go clear buildings, right? SWAT teams or Delta or Navy SEAL teams downrange. And we haven't found a really good application for it. One of the reasons is that we could certainly apply our system to that distance. But on the military side, you don't need to be that freaking accurate when you're that close, mm-hmm. right? Mm. And so we were interested. We were wondering, are you creating a training scar by making these guys that accurate? In other words, they'll take more time to take the shot than they need to. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies also to bow hunting. Mm-hmm. So what I plan to do is probably get a balloon about 9 inches diameter or whatever. I think that's like, I did some research on this, like the vitals of an antelope is 9 inches and the elk is 14 or something. So use the smallest one. And the idea isn't to be able to hit 5 inches or 4 inches at 40 yards. You know, it's be able to hit 9 inches all the time, every time. Mm-hmm. And then instead of making your balloon short, smaller at 40 yards, take your target back to 50 yards. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
So that's probably the way that we'll progress it. I do know that at least for mule deer out here, I want to be fairly comfortable at 60 yards. You know, and by God, my yard, I was.
You're the 60-yard master.
I was like 60-yard master in my yard, but, you know, on the field, I was not that accurate. And yeah. So obviously I've got work to do. And when I talk about the distraction, that's kind of the distraction is, you know, you get caught up in really being super accurate when you don't really need to be that accurate. You need to be able to hit that 9 inches under stress. And that's a different way of shooting. And so, but one of the things that we talk about when we're working with guys who go out in the field, either going in military selection or, you know, doing some climb, we don't want them to get to the field and experience something physically that they haven't felt in training already. And you know what? That's what I experienced when I was hunting. I was like, yeah, you know, my shooting in my yard, it wasn't like this real shooting I'm doing right here.
Yeah, this is new territory. Yeah.
And that's a coaching error, right? I miscoached mm-hmm. myself. It shows you I'm a slow learner, I guess. I should have knew that. I actually had plans to start deploying range fitness in my own shooting last summer. But you know what? I got caught up in trying to figure out which bow was working and which, you know, friggin' release was working, you know, and you know, which arrow I should be using because, you know, I have to have a certain spine weight or all.
Yeah.
It was all a goddamn distraction. I should have been doing range fitness from the, once I could hit the target, I should have started range fitness.
Yeah. Put the time in, nothing replaces it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's interesting. I have so many thoughts. I would love to follow your developments with that because, like, just that idea of hitting that, you know, that 9-inch balloon, it was like, you know, is that contradictory to the idea that you hear so often, which I think is helpful and true of, like, aim small, miss small, like that mindset of aim very precise so that you're off by a small margin, and how does that affect it? Man, that could go so many places. We'll have to chat about that, and maybe we might end up doing a whole nother show about what comes of that shooting. That would be fun.
You know, and the beauty of that is those are two theories, right? All that matters is what works for you in the field.
Yeah.
And so, you know, aim small, miss small might work for you, and this other system might work for somebody else. But that's one of the beauties of our approach is those are theoretical arguments, which are fine and dandy and certainly have a place, but all that really matters is what works in the field, and that'll be our real test. You know, the only problem with bow hunting, of course, it's not like you. I don't know. I might try getting hunting coyotes with my bow this year, or to get just more opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. To test it. That's a problem with bow hunting. And here in Wyoming, you can't go out and sneak on something and shoot them with a, you know, a rubber dart, because that's called harassment. Although that would be awesome. But,
that would be fun.
I wish we had some really, you know, smart cows who
right.
You could go try to shoot, you know, or maybe some wily sheep or something where it wouldn't do it. But, yeah.
That's funny.
Just to get practice, right? Just to see if the theory is working. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things, obviously. That
yeah.
We're,
yeah, that's cool. Well, let's transition in. We're almost 40 minutes into this conversation with a strength and conditioning coach and haven't really talked about fitness much, which is kind of cool. But we better cover it, right? So in the first episode we did with you, you know, we got pretty specific about some of the demands of backcountry hunting and talked about a plan that you have developed specifically, you know, programming to prepare for an extended backcountry hunt. So I don't want to completely rehash that, and would definitely encourage all the listeners to go back to episode 5 and listen to that as we get into it. But I do want to have this conversation and then dive on to some specifics that we didn't cover last time. But just to begin with, just to kind of set some framework, what do you see is that are some of the unique fitness or physical demands of backcountry hunting? And some of the sort of specific strength or endurance attributes that the ideal backcountry hunter should work towards, and, you know, balance and physical capabilities and that overall big picture.
You know, I think the first one is what we call mountain endurance, and there's a couple different elements to it, but practically on the endurance side, we're talking about the ability to hike uphill under load, and because you're always loaded when you're at least backcountry hunting. And I think my pack was super light. That's one of the things about I'd never hiked like that in August and stuff, hunting those deer, having to carry your damn water up.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
a lot of water decisions, so the ability to hike uphill under load, and that's a specific type of endurance, and you need to train that. In other words, if you're just running flat on the ground with no pack, it's not the same as hiking uphill under load. So that's, from an endurance perspective, that's the main one. There is obviously some flat hiking, you know, or coming out, you know, with your load or whatever, but that's the main thing that we want to cover. The next is, and there's two elements to that. One is, you know, aerobic endurance or heart-lung stuff that's trained specifically for that mode. The second is just strength, you know, just a step under load up, some strength. The second thing is eccentric leg strength for the downhills. So it turns out that when you walk downhill, you're actually stopping gravity from pushing your body into the mountain, and every step on that is called eccentric strength training. And in the strength conditioning world, it's much more intense than concentric strength training. So the strength going uphill is concentric, and it's less intense than coming downhill. So for morph guys, if they're going to get sore as shit hunting, it's going to be the downhills that get them. And so that's something specifically you need to train for on a strength side, is that eccentric leg strength. And then the other one is really core strength, and for just not only for carrying your pack when you're scouting, but really when you get something down and come out. There's just some core strength that's involved there, and overall leg strength, what we call the mountain chassis, kind of the quads up to the shoulders, for carrying that load out. If you happen to get something down, you don't want to be totally crushed or not be able to do it. So it's really kind of interesting fitness demands. On one hand, you have, you know, kind of really, you know, basic endurance demands, but on the other hand, because of the loading involved, and, you know, a few athletes in the mountains carry loads out like backcountry hunters, you know, and that's all eccentric strength, because hopefully you're going downhill most of the time.
Yeah, coming out heavy.
Yeah, you're coming out heavy and you're going downhill. So those are the ones that we really try to focus on. We developed that program, and I think we had good luck with it. Mark, you said you used it and noticed some changes. I'll be taking another look at that program again here really soon. And we always revisit our programs every year, every 2 years, to take a look and make sure that we're using our latest theory. We've changed some ways we train midsection stuff. I probably think we need to do maybe just some more unloaded endurance training in that program. Just a couple of things that we need to update and change. I'll be taking a look at it. But in general, those are the things that you want to get. What is interesting to notice about that is, other than the basic strength stuff, those aren't exercises, those aren't fitness demands. You really get lifting barbells or dumbbells around, right? Mm-hmm. You got to put a pack on and either walk uphill or we call us doing step-ups. There's no avoiding it. But again, we're interested in not what looks good, you know, or how jacked you are, but how you perform in the mountains. So we try to find those exercises that transfer, and that's all that we're really interested in.
Yeah.
So when you're do you find it better to do like real world application where you actually physically put a pack on and go hike up a hill, or can you get better results like working on more specific muscles in the gym?
Steve, you know that the problem with that for most guys is just the resources.
Right.
To be able to do that. So we did an alpine running program last year, and we happen to have, I don't know if you've been to Jackson, but there's a local ski hill here. It has it goes up like 1,500 or 1,800 or 1,600 feet or something in half mile, you know, so it's mm-hmm. a pretty good climb. And it's just an incredible resource. And we actually would take and load water up, pack, you know, get a hike, you know, pretty much straight up, water, dump it to the top, run down, repeat. Mm-hmm. And we were interested in primarily in vertical gain there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, absolutely, that would be better than doing step ups, because there's all these different little, one of the interesting things on the endurance side is not only heart and lungs, but there's also what I call the connective tissue. So just getting your ankles and your knees and your hips strong for that repeated motion, mm-hmm. right? All those mm-hmm. ligaments and stuff. If you have a mountain or resource like that, it will transfer better to the real thing than doing our step ups. The problem is, there's a couple of problems with that. One is, a lot of guys don't have that. Mm-hmm. The other problem is that weather can mess with you. Yeah. And like even this hill we did to get the vertical feet gain, because you had to come down, it took a lot longer. The sessions were longer. And so with step-ups, which is the exercise we use in terms of vertical feet, the training time can be shorter. It depends on – so there's time issues too, right? You have to kind of balance all that stuff together. We're interested in ideally, you'd go and do that. If you did it in a systematic way, on the mountain athlete side, you know, guys will say, hey, if I want to ski, I'm just going to do the sport. I'm just going to ski. Or if I'm just going to mountain bike, you know, I'm just going to mountain bike. And certainly they'll get, you know, fairly far doing that. And that's kind of the tradition in on the mountain side. But that's not the way other professional athletes treat it. They understand that a lot of times there's no set progression. They're not taking measurements. They're just going out there and doing it. And the difference between working out and training, mm-hmm. right? You're just going out and doing it. You're working out. If you're training, you know exactly what you're doing that day. You know what time you have to do it in. You know what your load is. You know what you're doing next. You see how the progression works. So there's a difference between them. If we could, yeah, ideally we would, you know, just hike up and down the King. But we can do that. But a lot of guys in different places can't. I don't know how. I know when I was in Boise, it seemed fairly flat compared to Jackson, you know. So even if you had to hop in your car and drive 30 minutes to find the hill, well, that's an hour, you know, on the road. That's going to cut in your training time, and eventually something's going to give. So it's just different things work together, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind too is, you know, as we talk about being very sports specific for our pursuit, which is backcountry hunting, you're not at all advising, Rob, that we do, you know, just step ups and only climb hills underweight year round. Can you kind of talk about the philosophy that you use of sort of like preseason, in season, off season training, and what that might look like for us? You know, it's, you know, January now as this comes out, and it's not that, you know, all of us need to be doing, you know, an hour worth of step ups today, but we should if we're, you know, getting weeks out from a hunt, right? So can you kind of walk us through those cycles?
Yeah, in general, the closer you get to the season or the trip, the more sport specific you want to train. And there's a couple reasons for that. You'll see this in endurance athletes a lot. They'll do their running year round and never really take a break, and they end up with overuse injuries. And that's one of the main things that kind of happens. The other problem is that you'll get strength imbalances where, you know, you'll get, if you're doing step ups every day, your quads are going to get huge and your upper body's going to melt away. And you kind of need them shoulders and the upper body stuff for that heavy pack as you're coming out. And those strength imbalances can lead to injuries. So in general, the further you are away from the season, the more general your training can be. And then as you get closer to the season, the more sport specific it should be. So for, you know, back country guys, we've kind of developed a packet of plans. I think it's that we kind of put our plans together, kind of lead guys in. It's like 7 months, and we kind of start out with just some body weight stuff. None of our stuff is easy, and our body weight stuff is all assessed and progressed. It's no joke, but we kind of start with body weight and just some unloaded running. And then we get into some gym-based strength, some of our chassis integrity, core strength work that we do, which is all loaded. We start guys heavy rucking or carrying a pack around, and then we keep in them distance running. And then we move into, we pull out of the gym a little bit, have guys do move back into body weight, upper body stuff, but we really start pushing loaded running. And then we drop them into the backcountry plan, which is really focused on getting guys specifically ready for the backcountry season. Our backcountry hunting plan is no joke, man. It's hard. And if you come in there not very fit, I mean, it's going to, you know what I mean? You'll get more out of it if you come into it more fit. But in general, that's just the idea is the more general your training can be. And as you get closer, you want to get more sport specific with it. And all our programming does that. I get guys who will say, hey, you know, why don't I just get your backcountry training plan and do it, you know, four times? I'm like, oh, first of all, it's going to get boring as hell. And then secondly, that's not the idea. You know, you'll overtrain or get some injury from doing all the damn step ups. You know, I want to send people to the mountains fit, but also relatively fresh. So they're able to, you know, have a really good season.
Yeah. And I can echo that from myself, forcing myself to be a guinea pig, with that last year. I started, I think, about January last year using some of your programming, and really went and did that all the way through hunting season, and it worked phenomenally well. Just would echo what you said. I mean, the body weight programming that you have is absolutely no joke. As you mentioned, it's sort of assessed. So you're doing, you know, here's what you're at day one, and then the program goes off of that, and then you're reassessing so you can legitimately see improvement. And I thoroughly enjoyed / hated that for sure. One plan that I received so much benefit from, yet again hated, and it's something I see you recommend a lot, and after having done it would definitely recommend it as sort of I think a good program to do before you get into the sport specific stuff for what we do. So I personally am planning on doing this one again leading up to the big game plan, but is the humility program that you have. Can you kind of talk about what that is and how might set us as backcountry hunters up well for getting sport specific?
Yeah, humility's, yeah, as one of the plans we developed on the tactical side, and it has body weight strength, So we've seen body weight strength stuff, but loaded work capacity. And I'm just bringing it up now to make sure I don't – I've designed like 200 plans over the years. So I want to make sure I'm talking the right one. But I think you were doing loaded vest runs, right? And
yeah.
Stuff with some of our dumbbell stuff, the loaded you know, like Scotty Bob's or when we did Man Makers to runs. Yeah, it's just a great program. What I like about Humility is there's really not a lot of equipment involved. I think you need a sandbag and a pair of 25-pound dumbbells and maybe a weight vest or something like that, and you're good. You can even use a pack instead of weight vest if you want. But yeah, it kind of like you said, I think it's a great way to kind of get your head right and increase your level of fitness, especially on the work capacity or endurance side for kind of loaded movement. When I say get your head right, it's just hard. And so it's good to kind of understand what, and you guys have been out there more than I have in terms of out there hunting and things aren't going well. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, right?
Yeah.
That's part of what we have got that feedback over the years is that, you know, your training plans, especially guys maybe like you, Mark, who do them alone, right? You know, they kind of get you mentally tough. I think you're running. Yeah, I think we have you running a 25-pound weight vest. You top out at 7 miles. That's no joke.
Yeah.
You know, a weight vest run. And oh, you're doing an unloaded run. Yeah, you're doing an unloaded run up to 12 miles. Yeah, it's I'm kind of in the middle of one of these cycles myself right now. But yeah, Humility is just a great overall. Again, we kind of developed on the tactical side, and there's actually quite a bit of a carryover between tactical and what backcountry hunters do because of the loading. Tactical is a little bit heavier, but many of the exercises and progressions that are in the backcountry big game training plan, you know, had their early versions in one of the first plans I developed on the military side, which was a pre-deployment plan for guys going to Afghanistan. So it's kind of interesting how the two mountain and tactical worlds, you know, enhance and improve each other's programming back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just I would just throw that out as a personal recommendation. You know, it's definitely not a plan to jump into if you haven't been doing anything. So if you're the guy listening to this in January and you're making your New Year's resolution to get in shape, don't start with Humility by any means, I wouldn't say. But if you want to do some of like Rob's body weight programming or some of the other beginner stuff and then work towards Humility, would wholeheartedly recommend that for sure.
Yeah, Humility is one of the plans I included in that packet, getting guys ready for the 7 months of training, getting ready for the backcountry plan. So it's definitely one that's in there. I think it's the one right the UD right before jumping into the backcountry hunting plan.
Oh, perfect. So you've touched on this, Rob, and I just want to spend more time on it because I think it's incredibly important, and I know it's timely to you because your theories have changed on it. But can you talk about chassis integrity, what you mean by that, why it's important to hunting, which, again, you mentioned in brief, and then what's changed with your philosophies on that and how you've changed your programming accordingly?
Yeah, you know, I a couple years ago, I kind of got out of the gym my own stuff and just started doing quite a bit more endurance. And I was kind of doing long endurance and lots of core training that we had done previously in the gym. We had a couple I thought was really awesome midsection training theories that I was deploying. And then after about 8 weeks, I came back in the gym and started doing some squats, some front squats. And what I found was that my legs were strong and my core was strong. The integrity between kind of that linkage between my lower body and my upper body was weak. And so what that meant for me is that the core training that we were doing was not transferring to actually lifting something heavy. And that's kind of when you really, you know, lifting something heavy or moving to something heavy is when you need your midsection. You don't need it doing sit-ups, right? This stuff should transfer over. And so it caused me to rethink how we are programming midsection strength and work. And what I decided is that my chassis integrity. I didn't have any chassis integrity. There was just no integrity through the entire system. And when we talk about chassis, we're talking about the knees up to the shoulders, that integrity through that system. So we changed our theory around quite significantly. We moved away from any ground-based core work. So no more sit-ups, no more flutter kicks, stuff like that. No more bridging, actually. Everything was either going to be on your knees or standing, because I felt transferred more to what would happen, what you need your midsection outside of the gym. We also moved away from flexion exercises. So flexion is when you kind of bend forward. So a sit-up, is a basic, flexion exercise. And as I thought about it, I didn't find myself using my midsection in the field to do a sit-up very often, right? Mostly time I was rotating with something, or I was trying to keep myself from rotating. I was bracing, or I was extending. I was using my low back to pick something up. And so we kind of started focusing on those types of exercises. And then we developed the other thing is that prior we would do this typical set rep-based programming. So we do like four sets through of 10 reps of four exercises. And we moved away from that and started programming for time. And so now we'll come in and we'll do a circuit of three of these exercises for like 20 minutes. Just grind through them. We're not working frantically, just grinding through them. And we've developed, we've made some modifications since I made that change. But we've had really good success with it in terms of actual transfer to the field. There's a couple things that can happen to your midsection. One is you'll tweak something either when you lift something heavy up and you're not ready for it, or it's too heavy. So there's a basic strength demand, but there's also a strength endurance demand. So, when you first start hiking out with that monster bull you carried or you killed, the first couple hours you're doing fine, but hour three, hour four, or whatever, that's when your midsection and everything else starts getting tired, and that's when you can get injured or not perform as well. So there's a real strength endurance demand to the midsection also, and we kind of found these longer, what we call them grinds, trade not only strength, but also that strength endurance element. And so we've had really good luck with them. I'm really excited about it. And no one else that I know in the country or world is really training the midsection this way. And with all my theories, of course, it's, we're always tweaking it and changing around. And recently we started tweaking it a little bit more. We'll kind of develop something and test it for 6 or 8 months. And then I'll think about it and see what the results are and tweak it. And we're doing the same with this, but so far it's been really solid. We really had great luck with it. It's a different type of midsection training than anybody else is doing, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done the freaking leg lifts and ab whatever, crunches, but doing this chassis integrity stuff, I picked up the chassis integrity packet from you specifically, so I'll throw that in there on off days or recovery days, and just it's helped me a ton. I feel stronger through that midsection, but then even things like lower back pain and things like that, because I'm stronger, even though I'm doing rotation and things like that might sound like a bad idea, it's really strengthened that for me and made a big difference. And I think when it comes to being under the weight of a pack, it's absolutely critical, for sure.
Yeah, I think that backcountry big game plan has a shitload of them sandbag get-ups, right? So you're hammering through those things. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, that exercise. That's probably my favorite chassis integrity exercise. You get all kinds of good work with that.
Yeah. For guys who aren't familiar, Rob, explain a sandbag get-up. I mean, it doesn't need explanation, but go ahead and explain it.
You just put a sandbag on your shoulder, you lay down and get up with it. There's not a lot of technique.
It's just that easy.
it's probably my favorite. It's an incredible work capacity exercise. It's so interesting to see guys who do it the first time, they get crushed by the sandbag, there's a mental side to it also, but it's one of my favorite, it probably is my favorite total body chassis integrity exercise. But it's a great, and that's how come I put it in that backcountry plan. It trains mental fitness. There's a hard work capacity component to it. And also get your midsection strong in a real functional way. Again, we're just interested in stuff that transfers. Go ahead.
What's the weight of that sandbag typically?
In the backcountry plan, I think we start at 60 pounds and you finish at 80.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the 60 to 80 is a big jump. I got to the point I got to the point with 60s, which, I mean, 60s were horrible when I started, but I got to the point where I was like, I was keeping some of my own metrics on like how many I could do in 10 minutes, for example. And I got pretty happy with where I was at, or so I thought. And it probably wasn't even all that great anyway, but you know, when you're training alone and in your own head, you think you're pretty awesome. And man, when I jumped to 80, it was like, holy cow, I was like starting all over again.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I did shoot a deer this year, and I was able to get the whole thing in my pack. And of course, I put my pack on laying down, right? Get my straps on. And it's just a sandbag getting up with that pack. Yeah. Just a heavy one. Yeah, so it's something hopefully we really transfers to. And I love that exercise. My athletes don't like it that much, but yeah, we love it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, this has been a great conversation, Rob. There's, I'm sure, going to be a ton of questions coming out of this. There's so much that I wanted to cover that we didn't get to, but that's the way things work when there's so much to talk about. So want to point folks to your site as well as ways to get in contact with things like that. I will say, first of all, before I forget to mention it, on your site, you guys have one of the coolest pages of exercises that I've seen. I mean, there's probably, do you know how many there are on there, Rob? Like, I mean, it's definitely over 100, right? Examples with videos of specific exercises.
Yeah, you know what, we just produced, I mean, we'll be 10 years old here next month. And so over the course of years, we've kind of made some of our own exercises and used others. And gosh, I don't know how many there are. It's kind of interesting. We were talking earlier about sophisticated design being immature. And over the years, the plans I use now use far fewer exercises than the plans in the past.
Yeah.
but yeah, there's just an incredible amount of great exercises on there. And I don't know how many, but a bunch of them.
Yeah. So just want to make sure that you guys have that, you know, as somebody who's, and I'm not saying this because it's not a paid endorsement, nothing like that. I mean, I've bought programs from Rob well before, you know, we were doing this. But, you know, for guys like myself who are training on your own, and then also I train at home, so I have limited equipment, kettlebells, dumbbells, sandbag, weight vest, pull-up bar, things like that. Rob has some awesome plans. Would wholeheartedly recommend them. And then that's the thing, is even though you're training alone and you're following programming from someone who's not there to coach you, you have all the examples of every exercise, what it is and how to do it correctly. But Rob, what's your site? Where can guys find your programming and things of that nature?
Yeah, the site is mtntactical.com. So that's Mike Tangle November, then the word tactical.com. And I answer dozens of emails every week about people have questions about fitness programming. And just Rob at mtntactical.com. I'm happy to answer a bunch of them. We're really open to guys and want to be successful.
Yeah. The cool thing, too, to throw that out there, is all those, essentially almost all those questions that you're answering by email, you guys usually put up, what is it, like a weekly post of questions that you received as well as your responses. So there's, even if you search the site, a whole bunch of nuggets of gold in those Q&A posts that you guys have as well.
Yeah, we have like, I forget how many years of them now, but yeah, we answer lots of questions. That's good. I mean, it's kind of exciting to see, you know, we've talked about getting distracted. I think that on the backcountry hunting side, guys can get, you know, distracted by gear and stuff and forget about their fitness. And gosh, you spend all that money. It's good to get out there and not suffer, you know, and be able to enjoy the experience. And physically, it's good. I think also it's kind of neat to, and what feedback we've heard is that, you know, by doing the training, you know, the 8 or 10 weeks or whatever it is, you're going to start before you do your trip. It kind of helps extend the trip a little bit more in a demented way, but it does. So you get kind of more out of it.
Yeah. I certainly had to remind myself why I was doing, you know, 50 minutes of step ups and pretending I was on the mountains. Yeah, it extended it in a way.
Yeah, I got into listening to books, which is a lot better now. So, but yeah, I definitely get an audio book. It'll help.
That's funny. Well, Rob, thank you so much for the time and for joining us.
Yeah, Phyllis, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much to Rob, and thank you, the listener, for joining us. Again, the show notes for this episode are at exomountaingear.com/62. Again, I share some of my experience with Rob's program in those show notes, some of my favorite movements that I picked up, and how I prepare for backcountry big game hunts with Rob's help. So we're not affiliated with Rob or his gym or selling programs or anything like that. It's simply a matter of the fact that I have done a ton of research, and I found that Rob is not only well-versed, he's well-experienced, he knows what he's talking about in terms of preparing the body physically for the outdoors, and I have used more than a handful of his programs to prepare for my own hunting, and have had great success. So if you have any questions, go ahead and contact us. You can contact Rob. All those links, all of that information are on the show notes. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you are enjoying the show, leaving us a review in iTunes or wherever else you might be listening to this helps us tremendously. We will catch you on the next show. Thanks for tuning in.